Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
America is once again the most attractive destination for investment in the world.
Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick testifying before a Senate Appropriations Subcommittee.
Under President Trump's leadership, the Department of Commerce is strengthening American industry from those that are the most popular to those industries that have been long ignored. We are focused on building in America and driving our economic growth. We will narrow the deficit of this country, both the trade deficit and our budget deficit, and we will deliver a new era of American innovation. Businesses are no longer looking overseas. They are choosing to invest in America first.
This is Agriculture Today.
Through the President's executive order establishing the Investment Accelerator, the Department of Commerce has already secured trillions of dollars in new commitments from world-class companies and sovereign wealth funds eager to build and invest here in the United States of America.
Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick before a Senate Appropriations Subcommittee on Commerce.
This surge in investment, paired with renewed commitment to fair and reciprocal trade, is reigniting American manufacturing. We are bringing car manufacturing back to Michigan and Ohio. We are reopening steel mills in Pennsylvania. Just last month, I went out to Arizona and welcomed the largest semiconductor investment in the history of the United States of America, $165 billion, thanks to an investment of TSMC. With respect to chips deals, we are improving those commitments to more than $300 billion, doubling the previous investment of those companies receiving CHIP Act awards without costing the United States taxpayer a single additional dollar. Our Commerce Department is driving substantial investments across America. Critically, the President's America First agenda goes beyond just economic growth and investment. The President is taking concrete actions to protect American workers and our national security. Under Section 232, the Commerce Department is conducting numerous investigations to protect, to reshore, and revive manufacturing capacity across our critical industries here in America. The Trump administration is imposing tariffs and ending loopholes. In April, we ended the de minimis loophole, which allowed foreign companies to avoid paying tariffs to ship small shipments into America, completely undercutting and undermining American small businesses. New export controls are protecting cutting-edge technologies and finally protecting critical industries and American innovation. In fact, the Bureau of Industry and Security, working with our partners in the Department of Justice, secured 22 criminal convictions, 32 arrests, 38 indictments, 231 detentions. We've seized goods of $185.5 million and additional seizures of another $40 million. Under this administration, the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office is tackling a mountain of unexamined patent applications left by the Biden administration, over 800,000. And we're successfully reducing the backlog for the first time in 4 years. In the past 4 months alone, we've removed 50,000 fraudulent goods and services from the trademark register that blocks the legitimate use of American businesses. Many of these purported trademarks come from what they call a specimen farm, which is basically a fake website produced by AI producing fake products that aren't really for sale. And we ended them. At NOAA, we are transforming how we track storms and forecast weather with cutting-edge technology. But remember, not cutting any instruments or data. We're adding. We're improving the understanding and prediction of how hurricanes intensify. This season, NOAA's research centers will deploy new small aircraft drone systems and additional underwater gliders. This year, the National Weather Service will be running experimental AI-based forecast systems, and all data will be publicly available. Together, this commitment to innovation means earlier warnings and increased accuracy for Americans no matter where they live. For far too long, America has not protected its workers and its industry. Thanks to President Trump and this administration's efforts, we are reversing this trend. We are reshoring critical manufacturing. We are eliminating unfair trade barriers and practices. We are investing in our American workforce. And with your help, we will continue to deliver growth and prosperity to Americans.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
I represent a very large district in western and southern Colorado, Colorado's third congressional district. It's basically half the geographic footprint of the state. One of the facts that blew my mind when I was originally running for office, and I think surprises a lot of folks back east, is that it's larger geographically than the entire state of Pennsylvania. So it is a big district, and general aviation airports are crucial for accessibility, for emergency services, for ag operations, for economic development.
At a House Transportation and Infrastructure Subcommittee hearing on aviation on Wednesday, Colorado Representative Jeff Hurd questioning Edward Bolin, President and CEO, National Business Aviation Association.
I wanted to ask Mr. Bolin, now that the FAA is 1 year into implementing reauthorization, how effectively has it implemented provisions intended to support and modernize rural aviation infrastructure?
Well, I think that was one of the really great accomplishments of the FAA Reauthorization Act of 2024. As you well know, we saw the funding levels for airports go from $3.35 billion to $4 billion, with a lot of that specifically directed toward rural airports. And that's critically important because, as you articulated, these airports are lifelines for rural communities. They provide medical support. They provide emergency relief. They're there in times of disaster. We need to make sure that those airports have an opportunity to survive. They have an opportunity to do matching grants. And I think that's exactly what this committee had in mind. And I think that it is an enormous step for the United States to keep its leadership in every aspect of general aviation.
Workforce development and retention are critical issues for rural districts like mine in Colorado's 3rd District. Pilot workforce shortages have particularly impacted rural regions who've seen reduced service to their communities as a result. And having a strong general aviation pipeline is key to ensuring that we have a strong supply of commercial pilots. What are some ideas or initiatives that your members have considered to address these critical aviation workforce shortages to retain talent in our rural communities? And has the 2024 reauthorization been helpful in facilitating aviation workforce development in rural areas?
Well, I think the bill itself did a number of really important things. It created some important grant programs and provided $20 million for aviation maintenance technicians and a pathway to pilots. So those are important programs. I think the challenge that we all have is how do we raise awareness of what these opportunities are. There are a lot of people that have not focused on the opportunities available through aviation or see themselves and what they see as something different and apart for a different segment of the community. I think the efforts to go into high schools, the efforts that are being made by organizations like AOPA with their curriculum are really important. I think we also need to focus on our ability to work with the technical schools and the community colleges, another opportunity to make people aware of what is out there. So NBAA is working through its members. Fortunately, we've got people in every congressional district, and that gives us an opportunity to be part of the local community. We encourage career days at airports. We encourage going into schools. We can't do enough to express the opportunities that are available, the life-changing opportunities in aviation, and specifically general aviation.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
And I was talking to one of the senators last night who also is concerned like I am. Maybe they hear our voices.
Chairman of the Congressional Joint Economic Council from Arizona, David Schweikert.
Tax Cut and Jobs Act. And these are just the base numbers when they were first scored. This number actually came in half that. No interest is attached to it, but we stole this from someone else, but it was to make a point. Democrats complained about that. CARES Act, we complained about the excess of spending. The American Rescue Plan, we complained about. Then you add in the Bipartisan Infrastructure Act. It wasn't that bipartisan. I think they had just a handful of Republicans who wanted projects in their district. But you add it all up, all the things we have fretted over the last decade, and they don't even add up to the amount of borrowing that's in the Senate reconciliation budget. Because it's so much easier here just to spend and just borrow it. There's this attitude here, give it to me now. Oh, you guys will figure out something in the future. And for anyone out there who's Look, we've worked with some of the Doge folks because I have the economists, but go on their official website right now. They think next year, 2026 fiscal year, we can save $160 billion. That's real money, but it's only if we borrow $6 billion a day, 24, 23 days of borrowing. That's everything we've gotten. There's this inability for members of Congress, our staff, the public, to understand the scale of what we're up against. If we do the Senate reconciliation budget with our baseline, we double U.S. debt in 10 years. I'm going to say it a couple of times so it sinks in. Debt held by the public, and they're using 2034. We prefer to use 2035 because that's more of an honest budget window. But you start to look at what the Senate resolution, this was baseline debt. They add another 32.7% to the debt. And if we do what the Senate put out in their budget reconciliation, we functionally double publicly held debt in the United States. What took us 240 years to do, bless us, we can do in 10. Because we're good at borrowing money, handing things out, telling people there's no consequences, making crap up, saying, it's health care for illegals. Okay, shouldn't do that. But it's only a couple days of borrowing over a year. You got to do lots and lots and lots of difficult things. And we've done entire presentations where we've shown you could revolutionize the cost of healthcare. We've actually looked at one data set, and we've been studying this now for months. If I came to you, Mr. Speaker, and said, just in Medicare, duplicative MRI scans, PET scans, X-rays, ultrasounds, could be as much as $25 billion a year. Duplicative scans. What if you got your knee scanned and you just attach it to this thing so it's portable with you? That's $250 billion over 10 years. Is that a cut? No. It's just a simple use of almost a free technology that's out there where you can load them on this and it's portable with you. We get lobbyists who don't like that idea because apparently they make money on the duplications. The inefficiencies, the frauds, those things are a business model now. When government controls functionally a quarter of all the spending in the United States, of all the GDP, and a big chunk of that is functionally waste and fraud and misallocations, bad design, give it whatever anachronism you want or title you want. Many of the lobbyists that are walking these hallways are here to stop us from modernizing the system and bringing it into this century and just using the technology. You walk around with a supercomputer in your pocket. This could crash the price of healthcare, make you healthier, give you access, all these things. And there's an army of people trying to stop us. Remember, telehealth here was an absolute war. There were millions being spent to stop it because it screwed up people's business models.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Mr. Secretary, I think I'm like most Americans. I agree with some of the things that you and the White House have done on tariffs, disagree with others. It's clear to me that the president listens to your advice about tariffs, so I want to spend my precious time trying to understand how you think.
Hearing on Wednesday before the Senate Appropriations Subcommittee on Commerce, Louisiana Republican Senator John Kennedy questioning the Secretary of Commerce, Howard Lutnick.
If Vietnam, for example, came to you tomorrow and said, okay, Mr. Secretary, you win. We're going to remove all tariffs and all trade barriers. Would the United States please do the same? Would you accept that deal?
Absolutely not. Okay. Absolutely not. That would be the silliest thing we could do.
Why is that?
Vietnam has a $125 billion exports to us and imports from us $12.5 million. And you're thinking, Vietnam exports $125 billion?
I'm aware of the figures, but tell me.
But where do they get it from? They buy $90 billion from China, then they mark it up and send it to us.
So you
would just a pathway of China to us.
You wouldn't accept that deal.
No, it's a terrible deal. We're the one with money. We're the one with the store. Of course they want us to take
down.
What's
the purpose of reciprocity then? Is reciprocity not one of your goals? Are you telling the president that we shouldn't seek reciprocity? If that's what you're telling him, why are you trying to do these trade deals?
What do we want? We want to encourage Vietnam to produce products they're great at producing.
But I want to get back to reciprocity. You just said you don't believe in, you don't accept reciprocity as a goal. What are you negotiating in these trade deals?
Why would we open our bank account and their bank account?
Why are you negotiating trade deals? You're trying to get other countries to lower their tariffs and trade barriers in return for us lowering ours.
That's true for the things that they'll take from us.
That's called reciprocity.
Of course.
So are you not seeking reciprocity in these trade deals?
We are absolutely seeking reciprocity with respect to things that can be reciprocal.
But you just said,
but when they're importing from China and sending it to us, they're not.
You just said that if a country came to you and offered you the ultimate reciprocity, no tariffs, no trade barriers, in return for us doing the same, you would reject that.
Of course, because they buy from China and send it to us. Don't you agree with me?
Suppose they said we won't buy from China.
Now we're talking. Would
you accept that deal?
We would consider it. For what things? For
what
products?
What would you want to change?
Well, there are certain products we want to reshore. We don't want other people making them. We want to make pharmaceuticals here.
Right.
We need to protect ourselves
for
certain things.
Let me ask you this, because I'm going to run out of time. Are trade deficits, are you advising the president that trade deficits are always bad in every situation?
No.
Okay. When are trade deficits good?
Trade deficits, for instance, let's say there was a company that had the cure for cancer. Let's call it cancer cure. And we were buying it and it was located in another country. We would obviously have a trade deficit with them because they have the only one of it. An example, our technology companies, our great technology companies, we're the only ones with it.
So a trade deficit is okay if they're products we really need.
If they're the only ones with it and we can't do it, then of course it's fine. But if we can do it, then we darn well better think about whether we're supposed to do it.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Guys, it's on the internet. Trust me, I'm not that bright. I just looked it up. It's there. You can find it.
Arizona Representative David Schweikert is chairman of the Congressional Joint Economic Council. Talks about nutrition.
The baseline of the next 10 years, we were going to spend, the federal government baseline was spending $86 trillion over the next 10 years. $86 trillion. All we're talking about in trying to modernize and change spending in this reconciliation budget, if you did the high end, so the House full all-in high end, which, please God, let us get there. But the high end is $2 trillion. 86. We're trying to get 2. That's 2.3%. And that's creating the bedwetting. Did they really love their money, the spending? But remember, if you don't want tax hikes, I don't want tax hikes. Borrowing is a tax hike. It's just paid for in the future with interest. Stop thinking borrowing is free. My wife and I, we've adopted a couple kids. I have a 2.5-year-old. We're incredibly blessed. It looks like he's going to be fine. He's going to be normal. He's absolutely a joy. When he's 22 or so, just to maintain baseline spending in the United States, you have to double every single tax. That's the morality of this place. For the lobbyists, for the groups that are walking our halls saying, we want more spending. Don't do this horrible, devastating 2% cut in spending over the next 10 years. Thank you for screwing over my 2-year-old. Your absolute immorality. If you're going to walk into our office and demand more spending, tell us what you think, where we can modernize, where we can change the cost of government. We've come here and done presentations that the single biggest expense we have in government turns out it's obesity. We did a whole model for the last couple of years, huge amounts. Remember, I chair the Joint Economic Committee, so I have like 5 PhD economists. We did the data, $9.1 trillion additional health care costs. Turns out the morality, if you'd help our brothers and sisters be healthier, but you got to do through the farm bill, you got to do through nutrition support. You're going to have to decide, are we going to have access to gluteites and other things, but are we going to use technology, the wearables, the other things? I have one of those data rings on. What would happen if one of the most powerful things you can do for U.S. sovereign debt stabilization is a healthier society? And somehow that becomes a fringe conversation around here because people make money
off of our brothers and sisters being sick. It's absolutely perverse.
If you actually go, I think it was a year or so ago, I think it was Goldman Sachs did this huge report on GLP-1s, blue tights. And somewhere one of the footnotes was sent to me. It had this line, a couple lines, saying if there was wide adoption and the United States actually became much healthier, much less morbid obesity, that there would be healthcare systems that would go bankrupt because they wouldn't have enough multi-chronic sick people to pay their bonds. Think about that. Everything's about the money here, not about the morality of having a society that's growing and prospering. Prosperity, I would argue, Mr. Speaker, is moral. How much of the crap we do here is not just satiating today's, you know, Twittersphere screaming at us, or something that's completely made up, but actually building a plan saying, here's the prosperity we're going to build for the future.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Maine's lobster industry, as you know, is so important to the economy of Maine.
And to me as well. I love lobster.
And I've always known that. And it represents Maine.
At a Senate Appropriations Subcommittee hearing on Wednesday, Susan Collins from Maine with Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick.
It's really an iconic industry for us of hardworking people that sustain many of our coastal communities. In 2022, the Biden administration proposed regulations that posed a threat to the very existence of the lobster fishery. If implemented, it would have shut down the lobster industry. The Maine delegation worked as a team, and we were able to successfully block those regulations and prevent them from going into effect for a period of years. Subsequently, the Maine Lobstermen's Association sued the National Department of the National Marine Fisheries Services in the Department of Commerce, and overwhelmingly won the case in June of 2023. And I want to read you just a little bit of what the judge said, what the three court panel said in its decision. It said that the service had relied upon worst case modeling that was, quote, very likely wrong, based on assumptions that the service conceded that it did not believe were accurate. Projections that are very likely wrong, obviously are not likely to occur. And what the court found was that the service acted in an arbitrary and capricious way and blocked the regulations from going forward. But obviously it's costly to go to court and to do that. So, Mr. Secretary, I know there's a new executive order that attempts to establish much higher standards for scientific research. It emphasizes rigorous evidence-based methodologies to inform federal regulations. Can you talk to us about how you believe that this new approach to regulation based in science will help protect the Maine fishing industry and our lobster industry from arbitrary and capricious regulations, as the court found was done in the previous administration?
This administration views the Maine lobster industry as an American treasure, and we need to protect it. And you will see as we do our trade deals, right? They treat the Maine lobster industry horribly. And in the UK deal, they said, we will invite you to 10 Downing Street and we will have now a lobster dinner. Okay. So we've opened, for example, the UK to lobster. We think this capricious lack of rigor in our science has got to end. So the gold standard executive order saying only real science, not opinion-based science, has to be the rule. So we protect our fishermen, we protect our ranchers, right? These are key things that this administration is going to drive for. So I completely agree with you. We will protect the great Maine lobster industry because it is a treasure for America.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Progress for the nation's winter wheat crop continues at a quick pace. USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey says for the period ending June 1st,
83% of the U.S. winter wheat headed by June 1st, ahead of the five-year average of 79%, ahead of last year's 82%.
And with harvest progress,
showing 3% of the crop harvested, that is right on par with the five-year average, but slightly behind last year's 5%, leading the way among the 18 production states in harvest progress is Texas, one quarter of the crop harvested by June 1st, just behind the five-year average of 27%.
As for winter wheat crop condition,
won't be looking at this for too many more weeks, but we will until the harvest approaches or reaches the 50% mark. The crop 52% good to excellent, 18% very poor to poor. A week ago, those numbers were 50% good to excellent, 19% very poor to poor.
I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.